This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our film critic John Powers considers the Sundance Film Festival the most important film festival in the U.S. He's been attending since the mid-80s. Sundance was created by director, producer, and movie star Robert Redford to showcase independent films. The festival attracts emerging filmmakers, film critics, and film fans, as well as distributors, producers, and agents looking for new talent. The films that succeed at Sundance are likely to make their way to movie theaters. This year's 10-day festival concluded on Sunday. We invited John to tell us about some of the highlights. Let's start with the two films that tied for the Grand Jury Prize, You Can Count on Me and Girl Fight.
They're very different films, and both are in a way quintessential Sundance films, I think. Girl Fight is a film by a young director named Karen Kusama, a Japanese-American born in St. Louis, and it tells the story of a young girl from the housing projects who has all sorts of anger in her because of her family life. And she devotes herself to becoming a champion boxer. And you see her go from being just a person who brawls in the schools to a person who learns to channel her anger and put it to some sort of good use. Along the way, she gets involved with a guy who, in a kind of nod to Rocky, her boyfriend is named Adrian, just as Sylvester Stallone's wife was named Adrian. And the whole thing builds to a fight that she has to have with her boyfriend in an amateur boxing competition. It's a very enjoyable, sharp film. Not completely original. It seems to be something of a populist crowd pleaser. But it's very, very well done. The young actress, Michelle Rodriguez, who plays the lead, is extremely good. And Karen Kusama is a very, very good director. The film was backed by John Sayles and Maggie Renzi, and it has some of that gritty feeling of their films. And honestly, I think that Karen Kusama is probably already a better director than John Sayles is. The film has a lot of energy. It works beautifully. And that was one of the films that within 10 minutes after the film screened for the first time, Karen Kusama had been made. That one of the interesting things about Sundance is that when your film does well, in 10 minutes, you can go from being someone that no one's ever heard of to someone that lots of people have heard of and suddenly have a big future. The other film is a relationships film about two brothers, about a brother and a sister, played by Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo. Laura Linney plays a single mom, and Ruffalo plays her sort of he's her brother, but he's sort of a combination of slacker, loser, and down and outer. And he comes to visit her in her small town where she works as a, where she works in a bank. And basically, the film is about their interaction and their interaction around her small son. It's a very funny, sharply observed, and touching film that at least one of the jurors, you know, Kevin Smith from Dogma fame, you know, was seen crying after the film. And it's a very good exploration of sibling relationships. That's the kind of thing that Sundance films often try, and this one does it particularly well.
Would we know the writer, director, or stars for anything?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, the writer-director is a playwright named Kenneth Lonergan, who's best known to most audiences as the man who wrote the first version of Analyze This. I've read somewhere that it was actually 9 years between the time he initially wrote it and it made it to the screen. He's also a playwright who wrote a thing called This Is Our Youth. And just as Girl Fight was backed by John Sayles and Maggie Renzi, if you look at the credits of You Can Count on Me, you'll see the name of Barbara DeFina and Martin Scorsese. And I think it's interesting that perhaps the presence of these people as strong producers and people with real eyes for talent, somehow that gives you some sense that these were good films.
Well, I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, after Sundance, you came home and you said, "No more gay coming-of-age movies for me." You were just so tired of watching gay coming-of-age movies. Was there a genre that irritated you this year because there was so much of it?
No, oddly enough, you know, I think the one thing that irritated me most this year was the tendency to make movies cute. I don't know exactly how this happened. I probably blame things like Twin Peaks and Friends and the success of such things. But now it seems that when people in the indie film world want to create interesting characters, what they do is they come up with quirky characters. And probably the worst films I saw this year were the films that were trying to be so studiously adorable and cute. It must be said that this year's festival was probably the best one in the last 5 years. I'm not sure that the very best films were as good as they sometimes are, but the overall standard was extremely high. So I mean, it's kind of, if you want to say it this way, the best were not as good as usual, but the bad were not as bad as they often are.
There's a new movie adaptation of the Bret Easton Ellis novel about the yuppie serial killer called American Psycho. And you saw that at Sundance. What'd you think?
Yes. Well, American Psycho was the hottest ticket, I think, of the entire festival. I mean, it showed early in the festival and came with all of the notoriety that comes with the Bret Easton Ellis novel and with the industry backstory of the fact that at one point the director Mary Harron was suddenly discovered that Leonardo DiCaprio, hot off Titanic, was interested in starring in the movie. And suddenly it went from a low budget movie to a movie where there was talk they were going to pay Leonardo DiCaprio $21 million to be in it. To her great credit, she fought that and wound up with the star Christian Bale. And what she's done is she's taken a novel that I thought was almost worthless and unreadable, and distilled it into something that's a rather sharp and extremely funny satire on late 80s Wall Street men, who basically are hollow creatures except for their Nino Cerruti suits and their expensive business cards. And underneath that is a hatred and violence toward women. It doesn't sound as if it would be very funny, but what Harron has done is she's taken a book that was just filled with name brands and sharpened the jokes so that what seems like a very simple thing, which is a satire of selfish, greedy white men, actually has a lot of punch and force. What she also manages to do is capture the feel and look of a particular kind of high-class, high-tone, wannabe New York City. And it's an extremely well-shot and well-edited film. Her last film was I Shot Andy Warhol, and this is a great advance technically beyond that.
How did American Psycho do with the Sundance audience? I take it it didn't win any audience awards.
No, American Psycho is not the kind of film that audiences at Sundance tend to like. You know, the official idea behind Sundance is that you're promoting edgy, independent films. But the truth is the Sundance audience tends to want rather sentimental comic crowd pleasers. So you see lots of standing ovations for films that I think when they later appear in the world, real world audiences can't quite believe were received standing ovations at Sundance. What I liked about American Psycho is that it was one of the few films there that had real cinematic ambition. I think, you know, that one of the things that's happened to Sundance over the years is that a lot of people go making films that are somehow designed to get them deeper into the film industry. And so what they make are indie versions of Hollywood films. Something like American Psycho is quite different than that. And I think that's one of the things I like and respect about the film. It's especially true of people who've made one or two films. What happens is that they make a film that might be edgy for their first film. Then no one goes to see it, and suddenly they realize they may never get to make another film if their second film isn't somehow popular. And what that means is you see a lot of second films by people who made sharp, independent-minded first films who make second films that look like low-budget Disney films. You know, they're filled with cute characters, they're adorable, and they're building toward a sentimental ending. American Psycho did none of that. It was Mary Harron's second film, and she clearly went for it. And I respected that particularly because Sundance is a place where you can see people who usually don't go for it.
You know, you mentioned there's a certain kind of film that seems to go over at Sundance. And earlier you were talking about quirky, that quirky is very popular there. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I think that a lot of American independent films, and this is larger than Sundance, you know, are caught halfway between what they think of as the real world and the larger-than-life mythologized Hollywood characters. So what they're trying to do is come up with interesting characters, but unlike, let's say, the Europeans, which have a great tradition of realistically depicting characters, American movies don't really have that. And so you find something that's halfway between a movie star type character and an ordinary life type of character. And usually the way of doing a shorthand for that is to make people quirky or offbeat. Everyone has one or two qualities, and they might wear something funny. And it's a shorthand for saying, these aren't larger-than-life Hollywood characters. They're real people. But, of course, they aren't real people.
The big success, financial success, from last year's festival was the Blair Witch Project, which I think was bought by its distributor for like $1 million and, you know, did exceptionally well at the box office. I don't remember the figure. So what was the impact of that financially and artistically on Sundance this year?
Yes. Well, I think the interesting thing is that the Blair Witch Project's influence on Sundance will probably, it'll probably take another year for that to happen. But what does happen when you have a film make that much money is everyone thinks that there is a huge amount of money to be made in independent film if you do it right. So that's the first thing, is it somehow changes people's perception of what a film ought to do in the box office and what kind of films ought to be made. The second thing is it was a film that was shot very cheaply using video equipment. And I think the thing that's very striking at this year's Sundance was the way that the video revolution, in particular the digital revolution, and the internet revolution have finally begun to hit Sundance. I mean, I was talking to a friend, and we were saying that one of the things that happens when you're in the middle of a festival is that you see all the trees, and the trees are the individual films. Yet when you step back and look at the bigger picture, sometimes the bigger picture can be found in your press box, where this year, suddenly, I had so many press releases from things like Atom.com, which is a new internet thing which was buying short films to broadcast over the internet. Or you would read in the credits of films that it was that there were people who were internet people who were the investors in the films. And you realized when you went to a competition film like Chuck and Buck, a very amusing film by Miguel Arteta, that it was actually shot on digital video. And probably if one were to look back on this festival a few years from now, what you would realize was that the most important story was the increasing digitalization, videoization, and internetization of independent film.
My guest is our film critic, John Powers, and we're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which ended on Sunday. We'll talk more about the festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our film critic, John Powers, and we're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up on Sunday. Sundance is a festival for independent movies, and the meaning of an independent film has changed a lot over the past few years. What do you think is the state of independent film now?
Yes. Well, independent film has always been a tricky concept to define. Some people want to define it artistically, but historically, the real way of defining it has had to do with who's paying for the film. And, you know, in the past, it was very easy to tell. You had people who were working for studios, and then you had people who were going around asking their family dentist or their dad's best friend for money to make a film. Over the last few years, what's happened is that the studios have grasped that there's lots of money to be made from independent film. And so what they've done is they've set up their own boutique operations. So they're now making films that are in many ways indistinguishable from the old independent films of the past. They have low budgets, they have second or third tier stars, and they deal with material that seems slightly edgy by Hollywood standards. So I think that what you now have is a situation where you still have the people who are cobbling together money by going to the dentist or doctor or family friend. You then have the people who go to a company like Miramax, which used to be an independent film company, but is now part of Disney. And then finally, you have the people who make films for what are clearly major corporations. But a film like Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson, while its financing is clearly not independent, in its spirit, it's independent. Similarly, a film like Rushmore was made for Disney, but even though Disney's money is behind it, it's far more independent, quirky, original, and auteurist than a lot of the films that I saw this year at Sundance.
What's the importance now of the festival to you as a critic?
Well, I think there are two levels of importance of Sundance. The first is that it's an exciting thing because it may be the only film festival in the world where reputations can be made overnight. And the journalist in any critic is excited by that. You know, you're seeing films that no one else has seen, and you realize that if it's good, there might be some new star in the firmament, and that there'll be lots of stuff to write about, and maybe there's a great talent you'll be watching for years and years and years. And at Sundance, you really don't know that. Even at Cannes, you're more likely to know than you are at Sundance. I think the second thing is that the indie film scene is now an institutional part of American culture. And if you want to understand what's both good and bad in American culture, it's very, very useful to see the kind of things that are coming out at Sundance. It's sort of a barometer for let's say, what is considered edgy or avant-garde or out of the mainstream. You know, by that standard, this year's festival, which had lots of good films, wasn't very edgy or avant-garde. And probably when people look back on this period, maybe 20 years from now, I think they will think of it as perhaps one of the least bold and edgy and avant-garde periods in American art history, and not just film history.
What are the movies that you thought would have the greatest chance of really catching on from last year's festival, and how do they do in reality?
Well, I think that the film that I knew was going to be a hit was The Blair Witch Project. I didn't think it was a great film, but I saw everyone freaking out at the screening. And when you realize that these are people, you know, Hollywood people, you know, many of whom, you know, would step on their parents for a dime, to have them be that scared, I realized there was actually something going on in that film. As for the other films, I can barely even remember them. I think probably that what happens with a lot of Sundance films is that they succeed at Sundance and then fail in the marketplace. Last year's winner was a film about Vietnam called Three Seasons, which came and went, got some good reviews, but barely left a ripple. And the truth is, with a lot of these American independent films, including the ones that I really like, that usually happens. That the test finally in a commercial medium like filmmaking is the market. And at this point, most of the Sundance films don't really make it in the market. But enough do, and in a big enough way, that the dream is always there. I was talking very interestingly to a guy who works for one of the major distributors. And he was talking about the film You Can Count on Me. And he was saying he thought that was his favorite film of the festival. He thought it was really, really good. But that his company would never, you know, even if they could, they would never want to distribute it because they knew it couldn't make enough money. So he would pick up a film that was less good because he thought it would make more money, or at least there was the possibility that it would make more money. Because in the fantasy of film exhibitors and distributors, you often look at a film and you don't, and even if you think it won't make money, you can imagine a scenario where it might make money, where it might be a huge hit. You Can Count on Me never proposed such a scenario, which is to say, it was a very, very good film, really well written, really well directed, really well acted, people really liked it, but no one could figure out how you'd market it to make it a hit. In contrast, you could take a film like Girl Fight, which tied with it, and people could think, wow, this is a girl power film. I could see how we can market this. This might make $50 million. And so therefore, Girl Fight is a much hotter film than You Can Count on Me, even though a lot of the people, industry people, thought You Can Count on Me was a better film. They nevertheless realized that they couldn't even delude themselves that You Can Count on Me would make a lot of money.
I know at last year's festivals, there were several documentaries that were really highly regarded, two or three of them being just about Vietnam and its aftermath. What about the documentaries at this year's Sundance?
Yes. Well, it's a general rule of thumb that the documentaries at Sundance are always better than the narrative films. And I think, you know, there are two reasons for it. One is that there's less money in documentary, so you're more likely to be getting a genuine labor of love. In fact, one of the funny things is when you go into a documentary screening, what you notice right away is that the filmmakers and the producers tend to be maybe 10 or 15 years older than they are in the dramatic feature competition. That's the first thing. And then the audience probably tends to be 20 or 25 years older. It's a different kind of thing. The commitments that people have in documentary are different. They tend not to go into it to make money. So that's the first thing, which is one reason why documentary tends to be very strong. I think the second thing is that the world is really interesting. And I remember once talking to this great Brazilian filmmaker, Nelson Pereira dos Santos, who was saying that whenever he was asked to be on a jury, he always preferred to be on the documentary jury. Because he said the problem is in feature films that if a dramatic film is bad, there's nothing in it that's interesting. Whereas in a documentary, even if the film's not very good, you can always see a dog walking along the street in the background to keep you interested, or you'll see somebody with a funny face walking by what the action. Whereas in a dramatic feature film, they're always careful to remove the dog and the funny face from the film. So all you have is the bad film. Whereas in documentary, you have the world. What that means in Sundance terms is that you usually have a competition filled with very, very good films. And what struck me was that I saw several documentaries, not a single winner. And because there were just simply too many films to see, I didn't see a single winner. And yet I saw four or five really terrific documentaries.
Name one of the documentaries that you particularly liked.
Yes. Well, I saw a very interesting film about the deaf community called Sound and Fury, which had to do with the implants that they are now putting in some young deaf people to allow them to hear. And the whole film followed a family, two brothers who had different families, both of whom had deaf children. One of the brothers had a deaf child. He was a hearing man, and he was putting in the cochlear implants into his child because he wanted his child to be able to hear and live a so-called normal life. His brother also had a daughter who was hearing impaired, but because this brother was deaf, he thought it was partly an assault on the dignity of the deaf community, but also on the deaf world, and might destroy her life to give her the implants because she would lose touch with her community. And it became a very passionate, angry film disputing this question of should you or should you not put in implants in deaf children, with all sorts of complicated familial, historical, and political reasons. And an extremely interesting film, you know, that held me from beginning to end, where the filmmakers had gone in and found the right people, and then those right people had let them watch how they lived through their events, very passionate, angry events, with mothers and sons screaming at one another, deaf people being furious with other deaf people because they'd let their kids have implants. A really interesting film.
Well, John, a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
John Powers is film critic for Fresh Air and Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.